Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's child protection system, and especially its division of children, youth, and families, has been under sharp scrutiny after two young girls were killed by their own mothers in a 10-month period, women who were under DCYF watch. But shocking as these cases might be, they're part of an ugly trend. Since 2010, at least 25 children, most of them quite young, have died from abuse or neglect, and the numbers are rising. These alarming facts led Concord Monitor reporter Ali Morris recently to dig into what was behind them. In a series called Fatal Flaws, Morris describes a system overwhelmed by growing numbers of kids in dangerous situations and child protection workers in constant crisis mode, hampered by inadequate funding and policies that seem heavily slanted in favor of parents over children. Today in The Exchange, fixing child protection. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests. Jeffrey Myers is here, Commissioner for the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services, which includes DCYF. And Commissioner Myers, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us, John DeJoy, legislative advocate for the nonprofit group Child and Family Services of New Hampshire. John also lectures on social policy at UNH, and he's a former state representative. And John, welcome back. Good to see you, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Good morning.
And also with us is Ali Morris, as I said, reporter at the Concord Monitor, where she covered DCYF and the child protection system in that Fatal Flaws series. And Ali, congratulations on this series. Wonderful work, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the first piece, Ali, in your series is about the death of a three-year-old, Brielle Gage of Nashua, and a lot of people, I'm sure, have seen that adorable picture of her with her little blonde pigtails. It's very frustrating to read this first piece, Ali. Repeated signs of serious abuse of Brielle and her four brothers, bruises, broken bones, cuts, and teachers try to help, doctors try to help, you know, law enforcement tries to help. The kids are put into foster care for a little while, but then the state sends the girl and her brothers back to their mother, and you just have to wonder, how is that even possible after all this evidence of abuse over a long period of time reported by a lot of people?
Yeah, well, and this was one specific case, but I think it reveals some larger problems at the department. And what I found through my reporting, my series actually focused on fatalities, but I think it kind of speaks larger to the child abuse and neglect system at large here in New Hampshire. And what I found is that New Hampshire has one of the lowest rates of founded reports of abuse and neglect, meaning that they're actually substantiated by workers in the country. And so what that means is that workers are rarely substantiating these reports of abuse or neglect, taking them to court, or taking action of some kind, whether that's giving the family services or removing the children from their home if they feel that necessary, as was the case in Brielle Gage and her death. And digging a little bit deeper into that, you see that in addition to that statistic, New Hampshire has really crushing caseloads for its workers. And speaking to some of them, they just had so much work on their plate that it was like triage constantly. And they were having a hard time really thoroughly investigating all of these reports and abuse, checking up on the children, making sure the families were getting the services they needed that could prevent them from coming back into the system later on. And so I think what you see is these really high-level fatalities are the ones being addressed, whereas these people with lower-level problems who may need mental health counseling, addiction services, and then, you know, maybe their children be okay, are not getting that. And so it escalates into these really high-level cases that may end in a death.
Can you talk about, Ali, please, what founded means? Because that was tricky for me going through your series because, you know, again, you look at Brielle Gage's mother, I mean, everybody in Nashua was saying, look, these kids are coming to school and they're just showing up battered. So you wonder, how can that possibly be unfounded?
Yeah, well, and maybe Jeff can speak to this a little bit more, but founded versus unfounded, a finding basically means that the worker can substantiate that abuse or neglect happened, which may meet the statutory threshold for what abuse or neglect is. And that ranges from state to state. And there has been some concern in New Hampshire that at least the neglect statute is not strong enough for workers feeling that they can go to court and present a case that would be founded before a judge. And I wasn't able to really investigate that because all of those court cases are sealed. And so it's really quite hard to tell whether, judges maybe are making rulings that would be questionable or whether DCYF isn't presenting cases that are strong. So it's hard to tell.
Well, an independent reviewer months ago said that the bar might be too high, as you suggest here in New Hampshire. So we'll circle back to that for sure. But to you, Commissioner Myers, as well, you know, people read Allie's series and they just ask themselves, what is going on that this is allowed to happen?
Yeah. First of all, let me say that Allie's series was very powerful. And in many respects, they really validate the report that the Center for the Support of Families submitted to the state at the end of last year.
That's that independent
reviewer. That's the independent reviewer that you were mentioning. And they came in and they took a look broadly at our child protection system. They looked at DCYF internally. They looked at supports in the community. And they found a lot of things that were very interesting. We know we have a lot of work to do within DCYF, and I want to address that in a minute. But they looked at the broader context of child protection in New Hampshire, and what they found was that there has been very uneven funding of services to help support kids and families in the communities over a number of years. We know we lost funding for voluntary services over a period of years. They noted very powerfully that one of the services that was lacking most in our child protection system was mental health services for kids and their parents. They've seen a real rise in abuse and neglect allegations in New Hampshire. That's unfortunately not unique. Other states have faced similar circumstances. We've had a very significant opioid crisis. I can tell you that over 50%, 51.5% of all the assessments that were reviewed in 2016 involved substance abuse of one kind or another. So over half of all the allegations that are coming in involve substance abuse on behalf of the parents or others who are involved with the supervision of those kids, including kids who were born substance exposed. There's been a sharp rise of that in that circumstance as well. So I think there's certainly societal issues that we need to respond to. And there are clearly, as the independent reviewer noted, a lot of work that we have to do. And I just want to note very quickly that we are taking the initiative and we are moving forward to help fix the system that we know is struggling right now.
Well, it's budget season, and you mentioned, you know, Allie mentioned the caseworkers, and I know that you guys are trying like mad to hire, so you've got that piece, you've got the substance abuse piece, you've got the mental health piece, and as you said, half of the reports that you're getting are due to substance abuse. So what are you asking the legislature for, Commissioner Myers, and do you think you're going to get it?
Well, we're asking for a number of things. First of all, we're hiring a new director for DCYF and a new associate commissioner. This will be a new position in the department. There will be a governor and council approved position. So the governor will nominate somebody when that person is selected. That person will have a broad portfolio to ensure that DCYF and the Sununu Center and our other juvenile programs are coordinated, that there's proper oversight and supervision. We're also bringing in a national firm to work with us on quality assurance to make sure that we are undertaking, our staff, our supervisors, and our caseworkers are really following up on the cases that present the highest risks. We're going forward and asking for legislative support as we implement what we're referring to as an implementation team to help implement the 20 recommendations that were made by the Center for the Support of Families. We're also asking for money. As I noted at the outset, there was loss in funding for voluntary services.
There's voluntary services funds. Means, again,
Services for kids and families in the community so that parents can get the parenting support that they need. kids have access to the services that they need. And so we're asking for money to help restore some of those voluntary services, as well as additional money for staff. I mean, that's been noted in Ali's series, and it was certainly noted in the independent report. The governor included $2.2 million in each fiscal year, 18 and 19. The governor's been very supportive of getting us the resources that we need so that we can reduce these caseloads that obviously have an impact on our ability to do the work.
Well, one more question, then we'll get John in on this, too. But you kept mentioning, Commissioner Myers, the voluntary services. Does that mean if a parent is drug addicted and because of that addiction, he or she is, you know, abusing the kids, you guys come in and say, look, parent, I think you need substance abuse, so you stop hitting your kids? Does that parent have to go to the drug treatment, or is it voluntary?
Well, a lot of the parents, we hope, have insurance of one kind or another. Some are on Medicaid, some have private insurance, and so benefits are provided through those insurance programs. What I'm talking about more is additional services in the community so that kids have programs to attend, that parents get counseling and other support that they need to work on parenting skills as needed.
Is drug addiction grounds for removal of a child?
Yeah, the legislature has changed our laws, and that is now a factor that's taken into account in determining whether there's abuse or neglect.
Go ahead, Ali, and then John.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, so those voluntary services cannot be mandated for the family. So those are services for people who may not have a founded report, meaning that workers feel they cannot substantiate abuse or neglect, but they feel there's some concern there. Maybe a parent admitted to some type of behavior that they think is not good for a child, perhaps maybe spanking them or using marijuana or something like that, that wouldn't result in a finding, but they could offer these family supports. And I actually met with one family who was effectively homeless, and one of their children died, they said, from sudden death syndrome, and they really wanted help. And so they said they agreed to sign papers saying that they had neglected their children so they could get some support from the state, which ultimately helped them move into a townhouse and out of the motel where they were living.
Well, I did wonder about that, though. And John, maybe this is for you. If a parent says, you know, yes, I need help, and yes, I'm losing control, and so on and so forth, are some of them afraid to ask for help because it might result in a report to DCYF? It might result in having their children taken away?
Thanks, Lauren. It brings up a great point. I think we have a system that's in crisis and that's been in crisis for a number of years. And as Commissioner Myers said, voluntary services are a piece of that, as well as many other things. Families may be afraid, but I think at the same time, we know from the audit report, as well as from common sense, that before these cases of kids being abused reach the paper, there are probably many other events, many other reports, oftentimes that are considered to be unfounded reports. And there's a lot to unpack in that, but I do think those are the very families we're talking about. That the first time a family comes in and there's an unfounded report, if we can offer them services, that can intervene in the potential for further escalation. Families don't wake up every morning planning to abuse their kids. Parents abuse their kids for a number of reasons, and typically it's pretty acute stress, whether it's poverty, whether it's job loss, whether it's drugs, whatever it is, that is typically the indicator that pushes families to abuse their kids. And we can intervene far sooner than we do through the voluntary services.
Is there a stigma, though, attached to asking for that help? And a fear?
I think there's a fear, but I think that comes back to public confidence in the division. I think when there's confidence in the division, there's less of a stigma. I do think the fear is that the division is going to, if you go to the division, you're going to lose your child. And I think that is going to be a long-term educational process, that the division is not there to take kids away. The division is there to provide that extra buffer to protect kids and to help families be successful.
Well, and after reading Ali's series, John, it seems like it's too difficult to remove children from dangerous situations. I mean, again, in the Brielle Gage case, you know, multiple reports from all kinds of people in the community who were trying to help, and still the mother got custody back.
Well, some of that may in fact be a practice issue, Laura, and the report talks about it. I've talked in a number of work groups with DCYS staff. There are practice issues where there is clear abuse or neglect that the reports are still considered to be unfounded.
How can you help unpack that? You said it's difficult to unpack, because that's the thing I still don't get.
Well, I can tell you what the report had to say. The commissioner may be able to speak to it directly. The report talked about when there's clear abuse and the parents may have taken affirmative steps to address the abuse, a number of workers will consider that to be unfounded, as opposed to founded but resolved.
Do you want to jump in, Commissioner Myers?
Yeah, I do.
This whole
practice issue and
so forth.
This is an area that really needs to be worked on, not only by the department, but by the legislature in terms of how we are forming our laws and our policies and so forth as well. What the report found was that DCYF and the child protection workers specifically do a pretty good job when there's immediate harm to a kid and removing that child from harm from the home. But there was a more challenging practice, if you will, with respect to the risk of future harm. So there was a tendency to look at facts and circumstances in a light and come up with safety plans that would maintain the kids at home to the greatest extent possible. When, in retrospect, there are factors, there are risk factors that were there that should have led to a finding of a risk of future harm that would have necessitated the removal of the child. And that's the area that we really have to turn around and make progress with.
Go ahead, Allie, real quick.
Yeah, well, and I think something else that I found in my reporting is just talking to workers and looking through material, it's not quite clear how decisions are made, what will be founded and what will be brought to court. And experts that I spoke with said that there should be a tool that everyone uses within the agency that helps make a determination using, is there adequate food in the home? Is there a history of past reports? Is there domestic violence? That helps determine what risk level a child is, whether that's high risk to no risk. And those high risk cases are the ones that you would presume become founded and get taken to court. But what the independent review found is that tool is rarely used, and its findings are rarely used when making decisions. And former workers I spoke with said it's a supervisor or an attorney that often their mm-hmm. discretion determines what gets brought to court. So what could be happening in one office may not be considered abuse in another office.
John, I can see you want to jump in.
And I think the complicating factor is a lot of the child protection workers are some of our youngest, greenest clinicians. What the commissioner is talking about of assessing future harm is a high-level clinical skill that that people need to learn and need to get training on. That's why the tool is so essential. The tool exists for these workers to help walk them through, but the report found that when it's done after the fact, not as a decision point in terms of what kids are at risk.
And I think why is that done after the fact? I mean, if the tool is right there and you're new to this job, wouldn't you want to use this to help you make the right decision?
It's not an easy tool. And again, the commissioner could probably jump in on this. It's not an easy tool to use. And I think we already talked about how overwhelmed the workers are, that the tool adds an extra step. And in any organization like this, you develop a culture. The culture understands what the court will approve, what a court won't approve, what a founded case looks like. And that begins to creep over years so that what might have been founded 5 years ago, the culture may suggest isn't founded today. And I think the tool can intervene in that by raising a red flag for clinicians to say, this is a pretty risky case, even though the culture may suggest otherwise.
Well, and that's one of the other things, Allie, that came out in your reporting is that right now New Hampshire sort of has founded, unfounded, and people are now talking about sort of a middle ground, a watch list or something like that.
Yeah, and many other states have this, some call it indicated. There are other options too. But this would create a third tier because right now, unfounded is kind of a misleading name because it doesn't mean the report was untrue. And this would create that third level to show that something did happen. So if a worker looks back in the past, they could see a true history in a family.
All right. More on New Hampshire's child protection system in just a moment. And we'll hear from you. Join us with your questions, comments, concerns. 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Fatal Flaws. That's the name of a recent Concord Monitor series looking in depth at New Hampshire's child protection system. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. The series unveiled a number of instances of child abuse and neglect that led to death. Since 2010, at least 25 New Hampshire children, most of them quite young, babies and toddlers, have died from abuse and neglect. And reporter Allie Morris tells us that the numbers are rising. We're looking at what's behind this, how the system has struggled to respond. 1-800-892-6477. And John DeJoy, Commissioner Myers, Allie Morris, let's go right to our listeners. Tim joins us from Nashua. Hi, Tim. You're on The Exchange. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was actually 3L Gage's neighbor at the time. And, you know, I'd like to mention that, you know, there is comparative negligence in terms of, you know, my not reporting and as well as the child services. You know, I had been there for 5 months. I hadn't even known there were kids there. They never left the house.
Wow.
4 miles. After they took the first two kids out, I hadn't seen them there. I go to work every morning. I hadn't seen the kids leave the school. So I guess my question is, you know, do we really not have enough resources to monitor these people after you take their children to make sure that the rest of the children are there and not being taken care of? Because it was pretty obvious to me. And, you know, I wish I had reported it, but as you said, so many people have reported it to no avail. And I really put myself in danger in these situations, knowing the people that were there, to report such a thing.
Wow. Thank you so much for calling, Tim, given your personal experiences. And there's a couple things to pull out of what he said. First of all, Allie, I'm kind of struck by, he said, you know, I didn't want to report because this mom in this instance clearly had some anger and violence issues. And it's understandable that Tim would think she might lash out at him.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone in the state is a reporter under state law. And I think there are laws that guard privacy around reporters, and you can report anonymously. So that's another thing to note. But what Tim also talked about is kind of a lack of oversight over these kids and this family. And I did find that through my reporting. You know, in one of the last reports over the 2 months before Brielle was killed, records show that, you know, no one from DCYF actually went to the house to check on the children. And the last scheduled visit was in December, which was, you know, a couple weeks after she had already been killed. And, you know, through the reporting, I found that oftentimes there's deadlines and there are certain protocols that DCYF sets for the number of people who workers have to interview in order to investigate abuse claims, and a timeline for when they have to complete their work and either take action or close out the case. And oftentimes those deadlines were missed. The independent review found only 1 out of 5 investigations was completed on time.
1 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
And as you found out, Allie, sometimes on time means, you know, it's very, very important. Because
yeah, definitely. There were children who were, a number of children actually, who were killed while DCYF had an overdue report into some sort of allegation prior to their death.
What was the instance or that sort of something that fell through the cracks, Allie, that led Brielle Gage's mother to regain custody of her 5 children, 4 brothers, also young, and Brielle Gage? Because again, they were in foster care, as you reported. They were happy. One of the boys said, it's heartbreaking. He said, you know, I love my foster mom. She doesn't hit. She uses a nice voice. But they weren't there very long. What was the piece that was dropped that allowed these 5 children to be sent back to this mother who clearly was, you know, abusing them?
Yeah, so I think there were a number of reasons. But through my reporting, I spoke with one former worker with knowledge of the situation who said that one of them was just purely procedural, that an attorney had been out on the day that some critical court paperwork was due. No one brought it by on the deadline. And so that was one of the reasons why the children were returned back to their home. But as I mentioned earlier, these hearings are all shielded from the public. And so you can't even get a docket number when you're looking for these cases of abuse and neglect, unlike a normal court case. And so it's impossible for me to get the file and actually look through, you know, what type of case DCYF presented and what the judge may have determined after the fact, because that is all sealed.
Well, and that raises a question that a lot of people have raised during this whole scrutiny of DCYF. And I guess I'll ask you, John, what about privacy rights? Someone said recently, I think it was just a letter to the editor in the Concord Monitor, that we've gone overboard with privacy rights and that it's time to start protecting kids. I just wonder what you think the balance is there.
It's a very delicate balance. And I think families do have a right to privacy. We need to make sure the privacy is for the families and that the department isn't using the privacy to avoid scrutiny.
Or that the family doesn't use privacy rights to avoid scrutiny. And again, in Allie's reporting, at one point the police show up at the Gage home and the mother, you know, screams at them and doesn't let them in.
Well, I think the family still has rights, but there are ways, even if the family tries to shield things or tries to deny issues are going on, there are still ways to investigate that. There are a number of bills that have passed recently that give the department the authority to go to court to get into a home if they feel there's immediate danger. But I think, just to go back to the privacy, to protect the privacy, but to make sure of transparency is really a pivotal issue. And we've made a number of recommendations about how you do that, how you have ongoing independent oversight of the division and still assure privacy. And one of the ways is through an Office of a Child Advocate. Allie just talked about the records are sealed, so the public can't see the records. That's true. But an Office of the Child Advocate would have full access to all records in the division, and they would be autonomous. They would not work for the department. They would work for, they'd be independent and they'd have oversight. But they would be able to investigate systemic issues to bring them to the department's issue far before we get to the crisis point we're at now.
Well, and that's a proposal before the legislature to create this new special independent Office of the Child Advocate. How do you feel about that?
And the department and I fully support the creation of an Office of Child Advocate. It's worked successfully in other states, notably in Massachusetts. I've talked with the child advocate down there a little bit, getting to know her and looking at how other states implement it. And I'm sure that the legislature, I expect they'll pass that bill and then we'll stand one up here in New Hampshire. I want to go back just for a second to the issue of privacy and confidentiality to make one point. And I can't comment on specific cases because of the pending litigation involved in those cases. But I will say that the balance that was struck between the right of privacy and confidentiality of these records and why, you know, information is not readily available to the public was a legislative determination that's been made over the years, you know, by our legislature help ensure some degree of confidentiality so that people will come forward, people will cooperate, so that, you know, the relative who's concerned about whether or not they would face retribution by a parent is going to feel free to come forward, whether a provider will free to come forward and provide that information. So I think when we look at this issue, we have to look at it very broadly. And ensure, I think as John was saying, yes, of course there has to be accountability. The department has to be accountable for how it manages the child protection system in the state of New Hampshire. That is absolutely the case. But we need to be able to allow that system to function so that it does protect kids. And I think there's a proper balance for confidentiality that should be taken into consideration.
So privacy doesn't just protect parents who may or may not be abusing their kids. It also protects the grandmother or the aunt who comes forward with concerns.
Yeah. And the providers out there, you know, the school teacher or the aftercare provider or somebody else who has contact with those children.
Well, and I will say this is going through the court system right now as we speak. There's an attorney in Bedford named Russ Riley who's representing a number of families who are suing DCYF over their handling of their cases, including Brielle Gage's father. And recently, a judge in the Hillsborough Circuit just said, ruled in favor of the family to move forward to unseal some of these records so the public could see them, writing that the court found the defendant's interest in maintaining confidentiality in this case is motivated purely by their own self-interest in minimizing public exposure of the alleged errors.
That was a case where the grandparents were protecting their grandchildren from two parents who were sexual abusers.
Exactly, yes. And so that was a pretty strong ruling in that case. And the attorney feels pretty confident that those records may be unsealed for public consumption.
Let's take another call. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jacob's in Goffstown. Hi, Jacob. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a foster father of three children, me and my wife, and I just wanted to mention a couple things. One was the lack of family judges within the state has extended out cases in the past, and I was just curious about whether or not there was going to be an increase of judges. I know they had to take some out of retirement to help oversee so many cases. And my second question is that I noticed my daughter was through one office and my son was through another office. One was Manchester and one was Nashua. And we just saw such a huge difference between the two offices and how their procedures work. When you go for fostering classes, they basically break down the whole system and what you can expect. Obviously, there's variations. But what I found is that, you know, Manchester office basically followed along those and was fairly predictable. And the Nashua office seemed to have just such a broad range of, you know, problems, missed paperwork. I'll give one example. When we were doing the mother had terminated her own rights, and then our daughter was going to start pre-adoptive paperwork. They had us redo this whole new safe home study they had just reinstated, which is fine, but it's like involves three different visits, all this paperwork, and you know, editing it and everything. So basically, dragged it out another 4 months.
Wow.
Then Manchester office came in with our son to do pre-adoptive paperwork. They sit down one visit and we're like, "Oh, when are you guys coming back to start this new safe home study?" And they're like, "Oh, that was our understanding. That was for new foster."
Well, Jacob, thank you so much for calling, and what an experience, and good luck with that adoptive process. And Commissioner Myers, a couple things. One is, it seems like there's not consistent policy from region to region.
Yeah, we're taking a look at our foster care system. First of all, let me say to the caller, I very much appreciate he and his family stepping up and acting as foster parents. It's such an important system that we have in New Hampshire, important part of our child care system in New Hampshire, and we want to do everything we can to support it. And it's through families like Jason's that we are doing that. So I agree. I mean, we have to have consistent policies. We're certainly looking at that now. We're looking at how we certify foster families. We're looking at how we support foster families. And we want to ensure that we've got consistent practices across the state. So this is a takeaway for me to go back and to check on these specific instances. But I agree that we need to have a consistent policy in terms of how we are operating that system.
Well, and he also mentioned two other systems in addition to this child protection system, foster care, which you addressed, Commissioner Myers. He also talked about the court system. And this, again, in Allie's reporting, John DeJoy, comes up a lot. You know, the courts are clogged. There's not enough judges. They close on certain days. In the Brielle Gage case, there was a court paper that was lost. What about the court system? Does it have the capability to handle these increasing caseloads that we've seen?
That's a great question, Lauren. The courts were discussed in the audit report, and there was a perception that the courts were actually an obstacle to moving forward. I sat on the commission to review child abuse fatalities, and Judge Gordon, who came in to speak to the commission, and Judge Gordon was pretty clear that he felt the issue was not the court system. The court didn't provide an impediment, that not enough cases were actually brought to court, that too many cases were being screened out or disposed of at the division level rather than coming to court. So he didn't feel that that was an issue. And I know workers talked about that in the audit report at length. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know what the issue is. But I think the court system will expand and contract. The court system is funded by the legislature, has the same hurdles that everyone else has. But as cases increase, they will present that to the legislature at the budget session, and they'll expand and contract it as they need to. Judge Gordon had a very different perception of that.
Here's an email that just came in from Andy, who says, "It's pretty remarkable that in not a single instance is a person ever responsible. It's procedures or policies or processes and money, but there's never, from the department's perspective, ever a person who is responsible for anything. Yet their response is always to add more policies and more procedures and more processes, which have all either failed or been ignored to date. So this is for you, Commissioner Myers, and thank you very much, Andy, for the email.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. I appreciate the question. Look, at the end of the day, our system, our child protection system, is a collection of people. It's people in the department. It's people in the court system. It's providers. And so it all comes down to people at the end of the day. And we have to work to ensure, and we are working to ensure, that we have sufficient staff, that we have trained staff, that we have policies in place so that those staff are doing their job in the best possible way. And we do everything we can to prevent any abuse and neglect in New Hampshire. But I agree. I think it's really not – we're not talking about some amorphous system. We're talking about a collection of people in various parts of the child protection system that have to work together to ensure that its success.
What specifically are you doing right now, Commissioner Myers, to prevent people working at the department from letting these things slip again?
Yep.
I appreciate Andy's point. You know, we're talking a lot about process and policy, but people ultimately are on the ground reviewing these cases, and we don't want them to make those mistakes again.
Absolutely. And so one of the most important things we're doing is we're bringing in a national firm. In fact, I'm going to be bringing a contract to the governor and council in May, and we're negotiating that contract right now. But that firm will come in and provide quality assurance training to some of our staff.
Okay, and that'll take time. And again, I'm not disrespecting it, but it'll take time to get that.
It's going to happen very rapidly. It's actually a 4 to 6 week process. It's not actually going to take months and months and months. This firm has done similar training across the country, and I think it could be very successful here. What this process will be, we will be taking a lot of our data that comes from our case reports and assessment files and central intake and so forth that get reports of abuse and neglect. It goes into a system that we have. This firm is going to load that data into a model, a tool that they use that is really designed to basically highlight high-risk cases. So that we can make sure that we're following up when it comes to safety plans and background checks, and behavior changes that are noted in case files, so that we are really prioritizing the highest risk cases. I think that's something that we can benefit from. I think that's something will help improve our oversight of the assessments that come in.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for the email. And what about the people, Allie? One of the most compelling pieces you did was interviewing the caseworkers. Do they feel responsible for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone who goes into this job does this because they want to help children and families. And I talked to a number of workers who said they left because they felt they couldn't do that. And it was too heartbreaking and stressful for them to not feel like they were adequately doing their jobs or helping families. And I think you brought up an interesting point with, you know, this takes time. And I do want to point out, you know, Brielle Gage, her death, which ultimately sparked all of this reform, was more than 2 years ago. And through my reporting, you know, as Jeff has spoken about, the number of cases that DCYF is seeing has really risen quite steadily over the past few years. But the agency has not requested more staff to keep up with that rise in at least 5 years. And I think, too, you know, just from national statistics, we're seeing that New Hampshire ranks in the top five for cases investigated per caseworker, which is 139 versus the national average of 67. So they're feeling quite under the gun and like maybe they can't do their job all
the
time.
And when you look at the national figures, you understand that because it seems like they have a much, 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 much higher caseloads and so forth. I can see you want to jump in, Commissioner Myers. Also, John, I know you have some concerns about the urgency, so we'll cover all that in just a moment. Stay with us.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Fatal Flaws, a recent Concord Monitor series looked in depth at New Hampshire's child protection system and the rising caseloads there. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, just a moment ago, we were talking about urgency and, you know, the agency, DCYF and DHHS, Health and Human Services, is taking steps. Commissioner Myers has described some of those. But there has been a criticism out in the field and among families that there isn't enough urgency. John DeJoy, you were quoted in one of Allie's stories as saying, I still have the same concern for kids that I had 2 years ago.
Absolutely. There's not enough urgency. And this is not directed at the department alone. This is directed at the entire system, to include the legislature. You know, and I think advocates like myself, we need to stand up and create the sense of urgency as well. You know, it has been 2 years. And the commissioner talked about some steps that the department is taking, which are very important steps. But at some point, we have to protect the kids today. Hiring the staff is going to take time. Bringing in consultants is going to take time. Making transformative change will take time. What about the kids today? You know, as of last week, and Commissioner, please correct me if I'm wrong, there were 2,800 cases, according to department staff, that had passed the 60-day window that hadn't been addressed. So the concern is—
And what's happening while
Well, and the concern is that, you know, we still have a system where we don't have enough staff in spite of the department's best efforts. Cases are going longer and longer. We're getting more and more behind. At some point, we need a hard reset. We just need to say stop and craft a system with the workers we have that is workable and figure out some other out-of-the-box way to address the backlog, to address some of the other issues. But at this point, we're running faster and faster, and we're falling off the treadmill. And that's really the concern that I have.
Go ahead, Commissioner
Myers. I want to come back to the sense of urgency. I've been commissioner now for a little over a year, about a year and a quarter, and I absolutely have a sense of urgency about everything that I deal with as commissioner, particularly this issue, because I agree that the kids cannot wait at all. And that's why, without waiting for the next budget, I went forward and brought to the fiscal committee some transfers so that we could stand up 18 new positions for a second shift for our assessment workers and central intake staff. It's known as kind of a 24/7 plan. Senator Booten at the time on the Child Fatality Commission asked us to take a look at this. We did. We put a plan into place. Of those 18 positions, 12 have been already hired and are working, and that plan is now in effect in several district offices. We have 6 positions that are still in recruitment, but we're making progress. Additionally, because of the need for more staff, I brought a second transfer item to the fiscal committee, again, not waiting for the next budget, for 22 new caseworker positions. Of those 22, 12 have already been hired. So again, we've got some more to bring on, but we're making progress on that. Additionally, one of the first things that I found out after I became commissioner is that the staff in the field did not have smartphones, did not have laptops, so they would be out working with the family. And in order to complete their work, they'd have to come back to the office the next day. That created delays in getting the work done. So I found money in my technology budget that had not been set aside for this particular purpose, but I moved it around with them in my budget. And I basically directed our technology office to go out and to purchase those laptops and purchase those smartphones so that the staff in the field had them. You know, that's a small matter, but that's certainly helped as well. I think that we are moving quickly to implement a number of things, including getting additional resources in the field. With respect to the 2,800 overdue assessments, John's right. There are approximately 2,800 assessments. So these are not open cases. These are not cases where there's been a finding of abuse and neglect, but these are reports that come into our central intake that are now have been open more than 60 days. So working with my director of human services, we've come up with a plan to utilize existing staff and potentially some external resources as well to go through that backlog, using all the appropriate guidelines and criteria. That's something that I'm monitoring very, very closely. And if we don't make an appreciable impact on that backlog very soon, then I'll seek more outside resources in order to address that. But this is not something that we're leaving for some other day. This is something that we are really focused on and wanting to address now.
Ali, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and I think what Commissioner Myers is talking about is how the department is responding. But, you know, this isn't just a department issue. And I think, you know, we've seen the legislature kind of come together on this issue in the last few years. But most of the things that they tackled last session, I think most would agree, were sort of low-hanging fruit bills, some housekeeping that needed to pass. But this year, you know, after this major independent review came out in December, Speaker Jasper put together this task force that would address it and come up with these recommendations. But we only really saw them begin meeting last month. And they haven't really put together a package of bills that the leadership suggested that they would be doing. And so I think that, you know, it's not just necessarily at the departments in the legislature. We haven't seen, I guess, the same quickness that you would imagine when Speaker Jasper first put together this task force.
So the narrative, Ali, you know, since these cases happened about 2 years ago, these two toddler girls, and then, you know, people start saying, how can this happen? And then we had the independent review that we've referenced. The narrative of what's the matter with DCYF? Why aren't they, quote unquote, doing their jobs? How much is that shifting to, oh, this is why they haven't been able to do their jobs. Hey, legislature, what's going on with you?
I mean, I think it's a mix. I think, you know, since those two deaths, it really came to the fore that this was a problem and that may not have been on people's radars. But I do think an important point, as we talked about, are these voluntary services. Those were eliminated by the legislature about 5 years ago. And so those services for families have not been available for quite some time. And, you know, I think that's just now coming back on the radar.
In the midst
of
an opioid crisis, where
exactly.
We know substance abuse can lead to child abuse. And in fact, we got an email earlier from Kimberly who says just what you said. Ali, 5 years ago, the New Hampshire legislators eliminated all funding to help and support at-risk families. Kimberly says it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see the connection between the rise in tragic outcomes in the past few years to the elimination of supports and services for parents. Kimberly also says it's astounding that New Hampshire's DCYF does not practice common sense policies like keeping a record of reports, even if classified, unfounded, or whatever language New Hampshire's DCYF uses to not act on a report, to see patterns over the long term emerge like other states do. I think you addressed this earlier, Ali, that people are now talking about maybe allowing DCYF to do this, to have that sort of third category versus founded or unfounded, which is a little too simple.
Yeah, they would be this third category. But I think further to that point is there was a bill last session that a lot of people in the department said was really critical that would let the department keep unfounded reports for longer right. than 3 years, which, right. you know, if you know the life of a child, obviously, you know, 3 years could be seven times while they're still in adolescence. And the legislature actually voted this down. They said, no, you cannot keep these reports for longer than 3 years. And I think that was kind of an upset for these groups who had been pushing to say, you know, these reports are needed to look back at a family's pattern and see how many times they may have come into contact with the department so we have a fuller picture of what we're dealing with here.
And what was the rationale for not allowing DCYF to keep those records longer?
The rationale was along the lines of privacy rights and due process, making sure that people kept out of the system. But when you do have an unfounded report, that's not something that is on a public record. It doesn't prevent you from getting a job in certain areas like a founded report would.
Ali, I know you have to go and head over to the State House, and then I'll unpack some of what you said with our other two guests. But just last thoughts for you, please, Ali, and thank you so much for being here. What's the one big takeaway for you that you learned, again, in doing an amazing job digging into this?
I think for me, it was just really sad to see these statistics and that they haven't been at the fore. You know, as you mentioned, through my reporting, I found that these instances of child deaths related to abuse and neglect are actually on the rise in New Hampshire, which I think is a startling statistic that hadn't really been out there before. And especially once you dig into it and see that at least 8 children had been involved with the division before their deaths, really shows, you know, if there are these red flags and people are making calls to report potential abuse and neglect, you know, is the state doing enough to follow through on that to ensure that these kids may be safe, you know, for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, again, in the Nashua case that you reported on, lots and lots of people were trying to do the right thing, and still the red flags were ignored or set aside or dropped to the floor or something. Allie, thank you so much. We know you have to go.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Allie Morris, reporter at the Concord Monitor, where she covered the child protection system in her Fatal Flaws series. By the way, we have a link to that series on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So, gentlemen, let's talk a little bit more about the politics of this that Allie described. And to you, John, I think, you know, we talked about the funding and Commissioner Myers talked about moving money around and trying to get more money. But what about the policies that the legislature has or has not allowed the agency to follow that might allow agency workers to catch those red flags that Allie mentioned?
There's clearly been a conflict between parents' rights, which is what beat back the bill that Allie talked about, which is in again this year. There's clearly that conflict, and that's probably not a bad tension to have to make sure that we don't overstep. It's easy to overstep. But I think it comes back to division policies as well. I mean, the commissioner very clearly pointed out some of the things he's done. And my statement before about a lack of urgency was not directed at the commissioner. This predated the commissioner's tenure. But I think it does come back to leadership in the division. I think we heard about the different culture in the offices, how different policies are applied differently. And I think that's critical, that people follow the same policies in similar ways. And I think that's within the division's control, not the legislature's control.
Well, John, 15 or 20 years ago, there was a concern among some Granite Staters and some lawmakers, and I remember we did whole shows on this, that DCYF had too much power, that it was intervening too often in family situations and was overbearing. So that's one swing of the pendulum, and now we have this other swing of, you know, just kids falling through the cracks and being killed. I mean, what could possibly be worse than that? What do you think about this pendulum swing? Did we swing too far 10, 15 years ago towards parental rights and privacy? I mean, is that the outcome?
Well, I think it's always a reflection of who we are as a society. I think the pendulum is always moving. But I think that's why you want to have more and more people at the table. You know, you want to make sure you bring lots of advocates to the table. You want to bring legislators, particularly legislators who disagree with DCYF having power. You work that through in the process, and you hopefully come out with a better product at the end. This pendulum is going to keep moving. But we don't now want to go so far to the other side because of the deaths of kids that we start trampling on parental rights. There is a happy medium. We just have to struggle to figure out what that happy medium is.
Commissioner Myers, go ahead.
You know, we still want to promote family reunification and promote the family overall, but it can't compromise child safety. And that's the balance that we have to find in our approach to it, both as a state and certainly within the department.
Yeah, because people don't want DCYF knocking at the door every time they yell at their kids.
Well, you know, this is interesting. You know, given all the publicity and the articles and the news stories and so forth, as I go around the state meeting with our DCYF staff over the last week or two, I'm hearing more and more about how when some of the caseworkers go into homes, the parents are saying, oh, you're from DCYF. I don't have to talk to you. You should stay out of my business. So, you know, in order for us to do our jobs, we have to have the right balance.
And okay, is the legislature backing you up on that, giving you the authority, whatever, to go into the home and say, no, I really need to be here?
I think the laws are largely there for us to do our job. I think we obviously want to take a look at it. We want to take a look at how abuse and neglect is defined. There are a lot of people that are looking at that now. I'll tell you one story that I heard from our expert reviewer, the Center for Supportive Families. In the course of their work, they got a bunch of DCYF lawyers in the room and started asking them, well, why aren't you bringing these cases up? You know, what are the barriers that you find to going forward with some of the cases? And they say, well, we don't bring some of the cases up because we think the judges are setting a standard that's far too high, that they insist that we show actual harm to a child. And then he got in a room with a bunch of the judges who are hearing these cases and said, well, you know, what do you think the barriers are to improving the child protection system? And the judges said, well, we don't understand why the cases aren't coming up from the division's lawyers.
Well, so the right hand wasn't talking to the left.
And so at the very least, there's a lack of effective communication that I think exists and that clearly has to be addressed. And so we've got to look at our laws to make sure we have the right balance. And then when we have the right balance, and whether that's introducing a new third category aside from founded and unfounded, I mean, we're certainly part of that conversation now that's going on in the legislature. But when our laws are set, hopefully at the end of the session, we make any adjustments that we want to make to them, there's got to be, and this was one of the findings of our independent reviewer, there's got to be a lot of socialization of that. I mean, the lawyers have to be trained. The staff has to be trained within DCYF. We've got to meet with the judicial branch. They have to have a common understanding, as we do, as how the system is to work. And the advocates also have to have a common understanding of how our system is going to work. So I think that there's, as I said at the outset, I think there's a lot of work to do to get this right. But we are on the road, I believe, to doing that.
Let's take one more call. This is Pat in Concord. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Colin, I've got a daughter who's studying social work. I've got another daughter who's interested in it. And we've had some challenges as we prepared for that because we understand how low the pay is for social workers. And, you know, this is a area that requires them to go through not just a master's degree, but generally, you know, you're talking 6-7 years of schooling for someone to do that. And then you're bringing them into one of the lowest paying professional jobs in the industry. Is there any talk of actually changing that around? You said you have 12 of 18 positions filled. That means you are only accomplishing 66% of your 75% of your goals towards recruiting.
And I've got to close you out there because we're running out of time, but it's a great question, and one I had as well, Commissioner Myers. So
workforce.
What about that?
It's workforce, and we've got to look at our pay scales.
Can you pay people more? He's right. Why would anybody go into this?
We have to have the number of people, and we have to have the support in order to attract the workforce that we need, obviously.
How much does a starting social worker make?
It's very low. It's probably in the 20s.
In the 20s?
And high 20s or low 30s is the very bottom of the scale.
For all the hours,
for somebody
and all
who's
the stress.
Brand new right out of school. Right.
Who are typically bachelor's level social workers. Speaking as a social worker, I've been a social worker my entire adult life. Social workers are not paid like corporate executives, but I've made a very reasonable living as a social worker. So I think we're talking about entry level workforce. At the numbers the commissioner is talking about. And they are bachelor's level social workers who are filling these roles.
Well, we didn't have nearly enough time. Thank you both so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.